Hello, everyone. This is Cassie Burns, co-founder of All Your Data. I'm an attorney who's been using AI and machine learning for 10 years. I love data and love talking to people about data, and that's what this podcast is about. Each episode of Cassie and will feature a new guest. Each guest comes from a different background with a different approach and attitude towards technology. We'll talk about their experiences and hopefully we'll learn a thing or two. Thanks for joining. Let's get started with Cassie and
Tara Emery. Tara, thank you so much for joining us here today at Cassie. So, Tara Emery, you are Senior VP of Legal AI Strategy and General Counsel of Redgrave Data. Did I get that all right?
Yes. It's a lot of words and you got them all. Thank you.
Perfect. So, I usually like to start my episodes with telling people how we know each other. And a lot of times those people I know, I've maybe just met fairly recently on LinkedIn, but that is not the case for you and I. You and I have known each other for about 10 years now. And it goes back to a little company called Driven Inc. And we worked together. Our offices were just two doors down from each other. So, So tell us a little bit about your time maybe at Driven, and then tell us what you're doing right now with Redgrave Data.
Sure. I miss being able to pop into your office just right down the hall and talk about whatever, and our little lunch is out. Mm-hmm. So I have been at Redgrave Data now for over 2 years. Redgrave Data, I was attracted to this company because it really is a group of people who are all recognized as experts in different aspects of e-discovery. So there's an attorney consulting group. There's a group of expert developers who are mostly also attorneys and come from our space. And then we have a group of data scientists. And so we put all of those abilities together and we can solve really complex problems. And so my work involves creating new kinds of workflows and technologies, working together with that group. On top of that, I also, in e-discovery disputes, testify as an expert witness, and I work as a court-appointed neutral. Right now, that's one of the titles that I have is discovery facilitator for a judge trying to help the parties get a discovery plan in place.
And I've already talked to you about this before, but I would really love for you to join the Academy of Court-Appointed Neutrals because I think you would be a wonderful member to that group. But let's talk a little bit again. We're going to jump ahead, and then I want to come back to some of the work you did at Driven and what you're doing now. But we were able to collaborate fairly recently. You reached out to me. And I honestly felt like it was an opportunity where I got to tag along and I get all the benefit and maybe didn't get to work as hard as you and some of your colleagues, but we worked together on a chapter for this book called Legal Operations in the Age of AI and Data. And you reached out to me and said, hey, can you help us get it to the finish line? And honestly, you were like, at the finish line. But we worked together and collaborated with some of your colleagues at Redgrave on a chapter on data automation or automation in a legal department, correct?
Yeah. So the other authors on this are Will Zett Lewis and Adam Poppelmeyer, who are my colleagues at Redgrave Data. And the chapter is on automation because, at least for us at Redgrave Data, that really goes to the heart of a lot of what we do. We look at what attorneys and legal staff spend a lot of time on, and that's where you find the most value for whatever you can bring to the table. So for us, it was really easy to write a lot of this chapter because that is how we approach clients. If we go to them and we say, what can we make for you? They don't always know the answer to that. But if we say, what do you spend all your time on? And let's help you assess that, then they know what that answer is. And then that leads us to the types of custom solutions that Redgrave Data spends its time working on.
And I feel like automation doesn't get enough attention that it really should. Everyone's so hyper-focused on generative AI and how it can be transformative. But it's really the automation, I feel like, that can really be transformative. And that may not necessarily involve something as like bright and shiny as generative AI. So I feel like in many ways, automation can be more transformative than, you know, some of the cooler things to talk about.
It absolutely can be. Generative AI is really cool. It's a very shiny new toy for all of us, and it has now taken up most of the conversation around what AI is. But AI has always meant the things you are used to humans doing that you can just have a machine automatically do for you. And the different ways of doing that vary. Sometimes they use machine learning, but not always. But automation is really the key. Instead of a human doing an action, you want the robots to do it. And so focusing on robotic process automation or RPA was actually one of the things that people were really focused on when they talked about AI before the LLM frenzy took over.
Do you feel that it's going to reverse back? Because I find myself in my free time, I play around with LLMs and generative AI, but my point of frustration is always the little, like I have to do this thing in this app and this thing in that app and this thing in that app. And I'm having to bounce from app to app. Producing this podcast is a perfect example. I jump around in multiple different things and I create efficiencies where possible, but it's really streamlining that process that is I would love to do. And that's really automation. I find myself more interested in how can I automate the use of generative AI tools and see more value in that than actually the generative AI tools sometimes. So do you think we're going to switch back to automation at some point, maybe?
I don't think LLMs are going away.
Right.
They are very cool. And when used correctly and well and correctly supervised, they can do really amazing things. And so I'm certainly not going to say that we're going to ever go back to the world that focused on how you handle problems without even considering them. But they do have their limits. And so depending what you're trying to do, in a lot of cases, you can find that working with other forms of AI, with automation, other types of machine learning, you can do all that. In fact, a lot of the things that we see people using the LLMs for right now, you can already do those with other types of machine learning. We just couldn't get the attorney's attention before that these are useful things to do, and it's worth investing a little to try to extract certain types of information. So I think that what the LLMs have done for us is gotten attention and investment willingness, and people are ready to put some little elbow grease into getting a good solution to do something that they realize maybe isn't best done by people over and over and over again. I do think that a lot of times we're skipping a step now. Is the LLM the right solution for what you're trying to do? Are there other opportunities to use other types of solutions that might just be straight automation, maybe other kinds of machine learning to solve a problem? And LLMs are generally pretty expensive. And so depending what you want to use them for, they especially right now may not be the best bet to actually solve a problem, but they have opened the door to people being open to different types of things to solve. And sometimes people really are so like, no, you have to use an LLM because that's what I want. And so we can have that conversation.
Yeah. And I find what's interesting is I nearly initially when I started playing with generative AI and building out custom GPTs, I was like, oh, this is a great way to templatize things and streamline it. And you forget about the chaos element to a lot of these LLMs, that black box that you can't completely control the output. Sometimes it does, in my experience, it creeps out a little bit. It goes a little rogue on you. So I think like your comment, you're absolutely right. If you want something and you want a repeatable process and you want the output to always be exactly the same, an LLM, you know, may not be the right starting point, maybe a great supplement to it in some phase. And I think you're right. We have to stop looking at these tools as binary. I think a lot of it is, These are tools that we're going to layer on top of each other that are going to get integrated with each other. But going back to automation, because again, I think it's a topic that doesn't get enough attention these days. What do you find is a challenge whenever a client comes to you and says, Tara, please help me create efficiencies, help me solve these problems. What are the biggest challenges to that process? And what are like some surprising wins that you tend to find, maybe one or the other or both, if you can share?
Yeah, I think that the challenge with any kind of proactive process change is attention, resources from the client. Even if they have budget, you often need people who are going to work with you through the details of what the team needs, how they normally run their process, what they're willing to put into training on a new process in order to be able to save time and money. And even knowing that they could turn thousands of dollars of spend a day into a few cents a day, there still has to be a curve to change your process and make sure the new process is working and that everyone knows where to go to get the new information and how it's going to show up. And this is a problem that's not new to me because I've been working on information governance too since the beginning of, in fact, that I went to Driven to do that. Not
yes,
to do,
yes.
e-discovery, that just jump into the pool and learn to swim kind of thing. I was already doing e-discovery in my work practicing law, but I got a whole different view of it from service provider side. So having been doing information governance for a long time, it's been hard the entire time to convince companies that you can be better, you can save time, you can decrease risk, but like, I can't snap my fingers and make it happen for you. There has to be real decision making. There has to be budget. There have to be all these things that happen. And it's really not that different for any kind of process improvement, whether it is on the information governance side or it's just legal process automation. So I think getting people to say, all right, I'm willing to put in the time, and also you have to break out of whatever you're doing day to day to start engaging in something new. And some people love that, but mm-hmm. a lot of people don't. So that is one of the biggest battles that I think just happen. And the reason that not every project or every conversation is going to lead to some massive budget saving win for every client.
Yeah. And I think the client has to come somewhat prepared, I would imagine, for it to have a successful outcome or at least a good start. Maybe if a client is out there thinking, I would love to maybe consider integration of automation and or LLMs into my workflow, I would say, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, if you haven't even developed an internal SOP or process document, you might want to start there before maybe you reach out and engage other people, because I do think that is a great starting point. If you have your manual process outlined and mapped out, it can be a great kickstart to integrating automated or technology-based assistance. Do you find that being helpful to that process, Tara, or is it even necessary?
Yeah, I mean, what you just said is right. Like, I want an LLM. That's the tool. Like, what do you want to do with it? I want to use a hammer. Okay. Like, what would you like to build with your hammer? Because there's probably other tools that need to come into play, not just the LLM. What is the goal? What is the thing that you don't have right now that you really want? And you can look at the tools that are being offered in the industry as well. Almost everything today says that it's AI driven because they know that is going to get more people talking to them. In the case of a lot of tools, it's the same tool it was before, but then once the LLM mania hit, they found something they could add in, which is cool. Like, it's cool mm-hmm. to add LLM capabilities into the tool, but it doesn't make the tool inherently more valuable to the person using it, where they know for sure that they are going to save money and time by using the tool. It just happens to have a little chatbot functionality in it. Is that the best use of the chatbot? It totally depends. And it doesn't mean that the entire tool is enabled by the LLM, nor does it mean that that would be an ideal approach to take for whatever you're trying to do. So those are all things to think about on either side. You want a tool to solve a problem, or you're looking at a tool trying to decide if it's a good fit for you. LLMs are useful for what they're useful for, but it doesn't mean that they're the best solution for every problem.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you have to have the time on the front end to spend some time. We know this from having used TAR, technology assisted review in litigation. You have the efficiencies you gain on the back end are because of the time you put in the front end to getting it set up and trained. And whether that's in predictive coding type of functionality with like a machine learning mechanism, or it's making sure you're sufficiently prompting with an LLM, or you're building out automated systems that make sense and are giving the result that you want, you have to put that time in at the front end. And it's not a magic wand, even though every gosh darn generative AI feature has an icon of a magic wand. And all of the software, it drives me crazy. Because how many times did we say it's not a magic wand? It's, we know from example, again, technology assisted review.
Yeah.
You get efficiencies, but you don't know when the efficiencies end. You know, you don't know when the cutoff is. It is kind of a something you have to keep an eye on. Whereas if you know you're going to review every single document, you can give some certainty of when that project is going to end. So I think it's a little bit more ephemeral, you know, a little bit harder to pin down, but can be useful if you put the time into it. So
yeah,
you were talking about Driven, and you, as you alluded to before, you came in for InfoGob, but you got sucked into eDiscovery, and you really were very early on, Tara, in my mind, crafting those more progressive technology-assisted review workflows. I mean, I think anyone that's been around the block, TAR 1.0, TAR 2.0,
yeah.
And I just remember you adding on creating efficiencies and improved performances. And now I also know you've been working with Relativity on some of their generative AI enabled workflows. And something we saw before with integration of TAR workflows into eDiscovery practices is something called the TAR tax. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind,
yeah,
and how there may be echoes of that as we look ahead into the future in the integration of generative AI tools in eDiscovery.
Yeah. So the TAR tax, just to make sure everyone knows what we're talking about, is if you decide that you want to negotiate an ESI protocol or disclose your processes around TAR, the other side may come back with comments and questions, and then you may find yourself in an endless volley of questions, running up the attorney bills, not able to start on your review confidently, knowing that you're even going to be able to go through with this process without finding a challenge. And at worst, motion practice where you actually have to defend what you actually want to do. I think that it is very informative to look back at the history of TAR and the case law and how parties handled it. So if you look at Judge Peck's De Silva Moore and the other early cases that came out starting 2012 around TAR, what you find is a lot of transparency, not even just encouraged, but expected by the courts. And parties knew this. So they knew if they were going to use this new technology, they probably should cut off the option of challenge and really be very transparent with the other side and come together on an ESI protocol they could have the court approve. And so we even see in some of these early cases, producing party sharing their training sets. We show them reviewing documents, even in some cases, together with the other side. And this is almost unheard of today. Most parties are not going to go that far. I think that as an industry, we've sort of coalesced around a few different ways of approaching ESI protocols. But it doesn't mean that you're not going to have a problem depending who's on the other side. So the TAR case law after the first few years takes a big change and veers way more into Sedona Principle 6, which says that a party that is producing is best situated to decide its own workflows. I see both sides of this. I do believe that parties get to decide how they're going to do their own work. On the other hand, I have sat across from enough parties to know that there are, you know, a lot of misunderstandings out there about how to run a good, solid TAR workflow, regardless of what type of TAR you're using. And so that means that when personally I'm negotiating across from a party that I already know is sophisticated and I can see that the people talking to me know what they're talking about, we're going to have no problems. We can blow through an ESI protocol negotiation very quickly and just move on to getting reviews underway. Whereas a party that is less knowledgeable, I'm happy to talk to them and try to educate them. But if they're just going to try to pound the table for leverage, that's going to be a bad experience. It's not going to be great for the producing party who just wants to get going. And that is where the TAR tax comes up. So the case law has, you know, we don't have a ton of case law anyway on TAR, but the case law that we have from the more recent years would tend to say that producing party doesn't have to disclose anything. They don't have to agree to do their TAR any certain way, but they still have a duty of reasonable inquiry. So they still have to make sure that they are following good practices. They have to sample their results and make sure that they can show with metrics that their process is doing what they think their process is doing. And so what's going to happen with Gen AI I think maybe we'll have a little bit of those early days again. Some parties may have sort of taken their lessons from the later TAR years and said, we're not going to share anything. But I think it is a new technology. And I think that if there's opportunity to negotiate with the other side so that there won't be confusion later, it's probably a good idea in most cases. But every attorney has to know their own circumstances. Who's your judge? Who's the opposing party? What's your document set going to require? How much are you really saving by going ahead with one workflow versus the other? But I think that even if it takes a little bit, it won't take as long as it did the first time, because we have been here before and done all of this type of evolution in our industry before.
Right. And you mentioned Sedona. So I'd love for you to talk and tell the audience a little bit about Sedona. I know you're an active member of it. You've helped draft many publications. So would love to hear about it generally and maybe what the organization is doing specific to generative AI.
Okay. So at a high level, the Sedona Conference is a nonprofit organization, and it has different working groups within it. And those working groups focus on e-discovery and information governance, privacy, security, antitrust, IP, and some other areas. And each one of those working groups is then focused on one of these topics. And they're called working groups because they put together groups that, first of all, brainstorm an issue that they think maybe there is some need for guidance on that issue. And then they will put together a drafting team. And so you can go on their website and you can see all of their drafts from the drafting team. They have lots of work product that I think is really useful to attorneys who are struggling with issues if they're not familiar, or if they just want some authority on topics that they may be reaching a little bit because it feels like an issue very specific to these types of things. So working group one is e-discovery and information governance, and I'm on the steering committee. I'm in my third of 3 years serving on that right now. I have been a member of quite a few brainstorming and drafting teams over the years. I won't try to remember them all, but the most recent one, I was the co-lead of the TAR Primer second edition. So this is how I'm so well acquainted with all of the TAR case law, because we have all of the TAR cases up until the cutoff of when we were drafting it in that. And then also, in addition to these working groups, the Sedona Conference has put on recently with regard to AI two conferences. We have part one and part two. I was co-chair of part one with Maura Grossman, and that was in April, and that was on litigation and AI. And then coming up is an IP and AI one. Both are in Reston, and we'll see what goes from there. In addition, each of the working groups in their area of the law is looking at AI, and some of them are putting together different things to work on. So in working group one, we have an AI brainstorming group that is led by Amy Sellers and Kelly Atherton.
All a bunch of great people. I mean, first of all, you're there. And I always remember you being associated with Sedona. When I think Sedona, I always think Tara Emery's. And I know I've personally, in my own practice, used some of the publications to help, you know, with the responses if there's ever any sort of discovery dispute, or to support a position when negotiating an ESI protocol. There are some really great resources out there. One thing I want to talk about TAR a little bit. You referenced in the TAR workflows the pretty much the defensibility of using those TAR workflows, the documentation of it, validating results, tracking metrics related to that. And I've talked about this before. You and I have talked about this offline. I personally see that discipline and rigor we as e-discovery professionals have put around the use of AI machine learning and e-discovery as a very useful skill set for the broader future of AI governance that we're about to start to see, because we've had to use AI in an adversarial setting, meaning someone is saying, okay, if you're going to use it, it better be good and it better be right. Mm-hmm. Whereas more broadly in, you know, consumer or private business to business practice, for the most part, there's not that sort of accounting of accuracy or proper use or anything like that. But that is definitely about to change with the EU AI Act and many other state laws that are starting to pass in the US. And I'd love to hear you think. How would you envision some of those skill sets potentially, you know, transitioning to the future of AI governance, you know, maybe hearkening back to your InfoGov days and now maybe seeing things come full circle?
Yeah, so AI governance is going to have a lot of facets to it. I worked with a client on records retention schedule related to development of AI models, and there's a lot that goes into identifying all the different data that can flow from AI model development and deployment of AI. On the information governance side, figuring out what all that information is and then tracking it and holding it to the same standards that we hold all our other data sources, including on the litigation side, legal holds and then identification. Those are all things that are going to come up now. But also, I think part of what you're getting at, especially by referring to the EU AI Act, is things like bias and auditing how valid the models are. Are they able to make accurate predictions? And so there are certain uses that are governed by the law now and will be increasingly governed by the law. But look, there's no responsibility to be good at business other than to your shareholders if you're a public company. Any uses that affect other party, third parties, whether through privacy or safety, health, those discrimination, those are all the uses that are going to fall within the high risk buckets and get looked at really closely. And so those will go through processes to look at them and absolutely have to be part of a responsible compliance program to not break the law. But there's a different question just generally. Does an AI model do what it's being represented to do or what the user thinks it has to do? And I think that this is going to be really tough because it is expensive to audit AI. The models are often, if they're changing, they're not static, then just because you tested it last week doesn't mean that it's still any good this week under that test. So I think finding the right balance of auditing and making sure and testing and having processes that stand for the use cases is the other one. So that's the other piece, is that people do all kinds of things with technologies that they get their hands on. And it's not always the one that was envisioned by the developer or even the person who decided to put it in that employee's hands. We know from discovery that we find all kinds of little pipe applications on people's computers because they realized they could automate part of their job with something a little better. And it's like, it's shadow IT. And so maybe what the actual application is, but there's so many ways to use different types of AI and making sure that users use them according to the authorized use cases and then allowing some kind of experimentation, but in controlled ways. Like, these are all things that are very messy. And so it's very case specific. What is the tool you're looking at? Who's the group who's going to be using it? What are they using it for? Who else is it affecting? What laws are implicated by it? How might they also use the tool that you haven't thought of yet? I mean, these are all things that have to be looked at as part of AI governance.
And I think what I've heard from some clients is they're very cautious about the spend, right? Because conducting a bias audit can potentially be very expensive. And we don't really, please correct me if I'm wrong, but don't have firm guidelines on what those appropriate thresholds should be. Listening to a webinar hosted by the EU AI office, that's something that they somewhat acknowledge. We don't really quite have everything pinned out. There's a lot of work between now and the time it's fully rolled out. And something that I like to advise people to do, focusing in particular, I think, on this year, is get your house in order. And again, harkening back to the InfoGov infancy days and data mapping, maybe conduct an AI mapping exercise. Just find out all of the AI systems in use and track key information about it. How's it being used? Is it hitting any of these categories that could be considered high risk, or is it in any category that may be subject to increased regulatory scrutiny? I think that's something that most organizations could at least get done this year, so they can start thinking, well, we've done the AI audit mapping exercise, and these are ones that may be higher risk, and or these are some that are core to our business as an offering as opposed to maybe operational enhancements. And then you might be able to say, okay, well, these are ones we're going to set aside audit budgets for 2025 because it may, you know, it may come up. So would you find that that's sufficient advice? Because I know that you've done a lot of data mapping exercises, what those compliance departments, what they're getting their arms wrapped around. My assumption is they're not necessarily logging all of the AI systems in use in their organization.
No, they have to. And I think even backing up a step, part of building a compliant program in a company is that all the uses do need to go through some kind of okay. If the tool isn't delivered to the employees with an explicit, this is the tool to use, don't use anything else, then if they want to use something that's not explicitly authorized, then they need to go and apply for that. There's just too many risks with this technology of, and it's really no different anyway than we should have the same thing for any confidential information and where it's stored. If someone's going to go put data somewhere that is not a secured environment and it's not considered part of your company's network, then they're sending things out that they shouldn't have. I think that what is unusual about especially the LLMs is they're so easy to use and they're so attractive and they are so useful. Maybe you could deter someone from sticking a few files in their private cloud by telling them not to, even though they were just doing it for convenience so they could work on something at home. We have mostly been able to, I think, train people to understand the risks of that. But the private cloud wasn't going to do 80% of their work for them. Mm-hmm. And it's just so attractive. It's really hard to keep people out of it. I've definitely heard stories already about attorneys who are using it in certain firms who, you know, maybe the partners didn't know about it at first, and people are going to find ways to make their jobs faster and better and get a better result for whoever they report to, whether it's a client or a boss. And we really have to appreciate that and then specifically instruct people on what they are and are not allowed to do. So if you set up a process like that, then mapping all the ways it's being used should not be so difficult. Although keeping up to date the use cases, that may require constant checking in and updating on that.
Well, and I think beyond the benefits that you mentioned for LLM, another thing is it's so pervasive. These tools are so easily available now. You can have a conference call transcription tool that's just a Chrome extension, a browser extension, and it can be dialed into a conference call without even showing itself as an attendee, and it's transcribing a call, and that information is probably not getting saved appropriately. So if it's a confidential conversation, so I think there is just, I think, increasing areas of risk beyond should we use this GPT tool or that one. But so many tools, you know, to your point, shadow IT, device creep, there's a lot to be concerned about for IT professionals, e-discovery professionals, compliance professionals. So
yeah.
It's not going to make our jobs go away. It's going to give us more work, I think.
No.
So, well, we're here at the end, Tara. Before we wrap up, I'd love to hear if you have any closing thoughts or something you're maybe interested in the coming year regarding AI or automation.
Yeah, I think right now people are still getting their bearings. There's definitely uses of it, but not everyone has figured out how it fits into their practice. And as we talked about, maybe there's been too rosy a view on things it can do well. Well, there's some people who haven't tried it at all. And I think that the ways that it is available to us will continue to increase. But also, I think how to use it well, we'll get there. I think that a lot of the gotchas that we hear, oh, it's not good at this or it's not good at that. If you're catching it on that kind of stuff this early, I think a lot of that will get improved and be better, which just means that the next set of things we have to discover about what it needs help with and isn't going to do well enough to be able to rely on it easily, that's what's going to come up later. And so never let your guard down, but do be open to all of the promise that it brings us.
I love that. Guarded optimism, to your point, yeah. It's maybe not as perfect and easy as we think, but these tools are only going to get better and more integrated. And hopefully, I think at the end of the day, we all have a lot of work to do. Hopefully, it'll give us some time back and we can create a little bit of work-life balance. So that's a hope, at least. Well, Tara, I want to thank you so much for joining today. I always love having guests join, but especially if they're guests that I've been friends with for over 10 years. And I know I've learned a lot from you today, and I'm sure my audience has as well. And to my audience, thank you so much for joining. And we hope to see you on the next episode of Cassie and